and then later the American companies wanted to control these resources. So yes, it's very complicated and very nuanced, and unfortunately, we're now in a situation where 9/11 has happened, and I repeat, after a lot of thought about it and after a lot of contemplation about it, I don't believe 9/11 would have happened, certainly not in the way it did, had it not been for our support of Israel over the years and for our duplicitous diplomacy. And also, many of your listeners may not realize, 10 years ago, in 1991, at the time of the Iraq War, at the time of the Gulf War, Osama bin Laden was not only one of the members of one of the most prominent and wealthy families of Saudi Arabia, he was a very upstanding citizen of Saudi Arabia who was meeting in the palaces with the king and the royal family because he and many in Saudi Arabia had very different views about the American army coming and launching its war against Iraq from Saudi soil.
Mark, we're going to take a break right now and be right back. We're speaking with Mark Bruzonski, who is the director of Middle East Realities. And this is certainly an area which we need to learn a lot about. Josie Houston, Straight Talk, we'll be back.
1570 KMCD Color Radar weather brought to you by Taco John's of Fairfield on this Taco Tuesday. Tonight, mostly cloudy and windy. We could have some flurries, low 26. Tomorrow, cloudy, a chance of sleet or snow showers, high 40. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy, low 20. Then Thursday, partly sunny, high 45. Well, Taco Tuesday means two crispy tacos, just $1.29. Order potato, lays, and a drink. It's a complete meal and a great deal for dinner on Taco Tuesday at Taco John's in Fairfield. That's the forecast here at 1570 KMCD.
Josie Houston, Straight Talk, we're back. We're speaking with Mark Bruzonski in Washington, D.C. He's the director of Middle East Realities, and I could go on and on about his background and his resume, not only academically, but the articles he's written and the media organizations that he has been on, both television and radio, and I guess fair to say truly is very knowledgeable about this area, and the area is the conflict in the Middle East, and we're trying to understand what has gone on and what is going on, and what we're finding out, it is complicated and nuanced. And the other revelation seems to be that we have not been told the straight story. Why do you think that is, Mark?
That's a good question, and our time is limited, so I'll just give the conclusion. As I said, after 25 years of involvement in these things, of course, it's not one simple answer. It, too, is complex and nuanced, but I'll give a couple of major reasons. One, the major news organizations in this country are largely corporate-controlled, and largely responsible now, not to news departments and not to newsmen, but to major corporations in our society, many of which have great interests in the defense industry, in the making of war material. GE is a good example. DuPont is a good example. That's one of the reasons. Another of the reasons is the powerful Israeli-Jewish lobby in Washington, which has a very strong reputation for pushing people around and making it very uncomfortable for people who speak up. They do a pretty effective job of that. They're allowed to get away with it, which I think they shouldn't be. But nevertheless, the media is susceptible, like most institutions, to pressure. And if you're a very good pressure group, and if you show people what you can do to harm them if they get in your way, then, you know, that has a major influence. And I would remind people that it's not just done to journalists and is not just done to politicians. It's done to people at the very top. Of course, in this case, I am thinking of politicians. Senator Percy, when he was chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Fulbright, when he was chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, are two very good examples of very eminent politicians who were at the top of their game. They spoke up against the policies that Israel was pursuing. They were targeted by the Israeli Jewish lobby, that's my nickname for it, and they were both defeated. Bill Clinton was essentially owned by that lobby, which helped bring him to power, and in a different way, because it's a different group of people, the Bush administration in some ways is even worse, frankly. It has in its very high-ranking second and third layers, people of the most extreme views, Jewish people of, not just Jewish people, of course, I'm Jewish myself, this is not a who at the Defense Department are Jewish. Pat Robertson, who's very much an active member of this lobby, he's certainly not Jewish. I emphasize this because it's a taboo to speak about it in this country. And maybe as someone who is Jewish and someone who represented the World Jewish Congress when he first came to Washington, I'm a little more able to speak about it because it's a little more hard to think of me as you know, someone who is anti-Semitic. Even though, of course, the lobby has a nickname for us, too. We're all self-hating Jews because we speak up for the principles and values that we used to think the Jewish community represented, and now the organized Jewish community doesn't represent them, so we have to speak up as individuals. So there you've got two powerful reasons for that situation. And then thirdly, America is a very insular place. We don't have the tradition of world affairs and of journalistic coverage. Anybody can go now to the internet and can read The Independent and The Guardian and find far more profound articles about what's happening in the Middle East than you can find regularly in any American newspapers. And there are some brilliant writers who almost never get published in this country, but they're known all over the world. Robert Fisk, who writes for The Independent, Arundhati Roy in India, Noam Chomsky, of course, is an American and a Jewish person and a professor, but you'll almost never see him on national TV, even though when he goes to universities, you can't possibly get a seat in the auditorium. So we've got a very serious situation in this country, and I think before 9/11, people were willing to just let it roll off their back and say, well, you know, there's a lot of problems, and this is one I don't understand. But I hope 9/11 has done more than cause people to put flags on their cars. I hope it's also caused them to say, what's gone wrong so that there are so many people not only who are willing to do these things to us, but there's so much support for them in so many places.
How much of an issue is our oil interest or our dependence on Middle Eastern oil? How much is that a factor for our involvement in the Middle East?
Well, it's a very, very major factor. I mean, that was the original reason when, after World War II, British and French and American interests realized that the Middle East was going to be a very crucial area and did not want to let it be ruled by the people there, wanted it to be ruled by regimes that we controlled and corporate interests that could manipulate the regimes. And now, into the new century, at least for the foreseeable future, the American economy continues to float along on by far the world's cheapest energy prices, by far the world's cheapest oil prices. I know Americans think, oh my God, you know, gas prices are going up. But they don't realize that in most places in the world, gas prices are 2 to 3 times what they are here, that much of what they pay at the pump is actually federal and state tax. And if they would just think about it in a different way, oil is pumped in Arabia, is then put on ships and sent halfway around the world, is then refined in refineries and put in trucks and sent to the gas pumps, and it still costs about a gallon, about the same amount as distilled water costs in the grocery store. So it's extremely cheap. And the reason it's cheap is because the regimes in the Middle East are our regimes, the Saudis and the Kuwaitis primarily, and they pretty much do what they're told, and not only do they sell us huge amounts of oil at very cheap prices, they also recycle most of the petrodollars not into their own economies and not into building up their own part of the world and not into solving their own social problems. They recycle most of those petrodollars into, one, secret bank accounts that the regimes maintain in European and American banks, and two, into the American stock market and into American industries, which is something we also want them to do.
Well, all of this is illuminating, and as for me, certainly, it's not information that has been readily available, I think, certainly to our average listeners and to the average American in the United States. It seems as if much of what happened at the end of the Second World War was artificial in the sense of creating an artificial state, as it were, for Israel and then and then an artificial, different, you mentioned redrawing the maps between Iraq and Kuwait. And it seems as if the corporate interests and our country and other countries basically decided what was going to take place in the Middle East, even though it may or may not have been what the people in the Middle East wanted to have happen.
Well, definitely so. That was the end of World War I that most of the boundaries were drawn and most of the regimes were put in place. It was the end of World War II that Israel was brought about with tremendous, at first British and then American help. And now you've got this situation, you've got these boundaries, you've got these regimes, you've got the Arab-Israeli problem. Having created these problems in the past, it's not so easy to fix them. And there are major interests which, of course, don't want to fix them. And that includes our own country, which wants to quote-unquote stabilize things. Well, by stabilizing things, that means they want to keep things as they are. But the way they are is what causes the problems. That's why the Islamic movement has grown. That's why Hezbollah has grown. That's why the suicide bombers or terrorists or martyrs, depending upon your political point of view, have been created. And people also need to realize, let's just take the suicide bombers, for instance. Where did these come from? Are the Muslim and Arab and Palestinian people somehow less human than we and less concerned about human life than we? Well, of course the answer is no. Anybody who's traveled and been to that part of the region knows that in many ways the family and culture and religious lifestyle is deeper and warmer than it is here in our own society. However, after generations of being humiliated, after generations of being quite literally tortured into submission, you now have this phenomena breaking out. And it didn't start, it took a long time to start. The first suicide bombers in any organized way really started about 20 years ago during the Sharon-led Israeli invasion of Lebanon, in which the United States not only encouraged that invasion, but then sent our own troops in, saying they were there as peacekeepers, but in reality they were there to help Israel twist Lebanon into a client state of itself. It didn't work. The Marine barracks were blown up. That was done by a suicide bomber, one of the first. And the whole phenomena of suicide bombing has spread. Hezbollah was an outgrowth of the war I just mentioned in 82. Hamas is an outgrowth of the Palestinian Intifada. This is a relatively new phenomena. And it's the result of tremendous repression, tremendous torture, almost every family in Palestine. And this is literally the case. Almost every family in Palestine has a family member or relative who's been arrested, beaten, or tortured or killed by the Israelis. And probably something else Americans don't realize. If you adjust for population size, the Palestinian population size is 3 million plus. So if you adjust comparable to our population size, just in the last 18 months, the period of the second Intifada, not even taking into consideration other times, the Palestinians have lost not 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 people as happened on 9/11. They've lost over 100,000 people killed with millions injured. Again, taking into consideration the difference in population size, so adjusting for that factor.
Well, this is breathtaking revelations, I think, certainly for myself, and I would imagine for most of our listeners as well. This is certainly not what we've been led to believe. Walk us through the, if you will, the hotspot geographies. There's the occupied territories. What are the different kind of geographical regions? What is the geography that's being debated and fought over, and who are the
two
players?
That too is complex, but I will walk you through it. Before Israel was created, and at the end of World War I, actually, there was an area called Palestine. That area didn't have firm boundaries because in that part of the world, there were, you know, it wasn't developed, and there were a lot of desert areas and a lot of tribal rule and a lot of local rule. So you had general areas. You had Syria. You had, then Lebanon was carved out of Syria by a French mandate. you had Palestine and then the desert to the east when the Hashemites lost out to the Al Sauds in Saudi Arabia. So when the Al Sauds were brought to power by the British in Saudi Arabia, the losing tribe, if you will, the Hashemites, needed a consolation prize. And so Abdullah, the first Abdullah, the current King of Abdullah is named after him, went for a meeting with Lord Kitchener, the British representative in Cairo in 1916, and he was essentially, the Hashemites were essentially bought by the British at the time for £1,000 for £1,000 a year, which at the time was a lot of money. And Abdullah the First was told he could go to a place called Amman in a place called Transjordan.
Now, there's going to be a test on this. I want our listeners to be following this. There's going to be a test on it. All right, I'm with you. I'm with you. No, I'm
and
taking
in
notes.
Transjordan, he would be given a kingdom. So he had never been to Transjordan, but he didn't have, you know, the Hashemites had been defeated in Arabia, so off they went to Transjordan, and voila, the kingdom of Transjordan was created, and the Jordan River became a political boundary. Most Americans may never have known, I was going to say may have forgotten, but they may never have known, that a Hashemite king, another Hashemite, was put on the throne in Baghdad until a revolution in 1958, when the Iraqi people had enough of that regime and literally dismembered the members of the Hashemite family and dragged them through the streets. That then led to the chaotic and repressive situation in Iraq and to the Ba'athist regime, which Saddam Hussein is the descendant of. Then, of course, in 1948, you had the civil war in what was left of Palestine, Transjordan now to the east, and everything to the west of the Jordan River being Palestine. The Israelis, the Jewish part of that civil war, was victorious. But it was victorious largely because it got a lot of Western support and because the United States pressured nations at the UN to approve the partition resolution. And that partition resolution, by the way, also called for a Palestinian state way back then in 1947, which we still don't have today. Today you've got this crazy quilt pattern. You've got Israel as of 1948. Then you've got Israel as expanded in 67 when it took the West Bank and Gaza. Then you've got the Golan Heights, which Israel also occupied in 67. And you've got little parts of southern Lebanon, which Israel still occupies. These are all considered by the international community occupied territories. To the Israelis, they're considered disputed territories. And in them, Israel maintains a military occupation, which not only terribly represses the indigenous population, but in which they have built 170 settlements, all kinds of bypass roads and all kinds of restrictions and all kinds of military fortifications. One of the ironies of contemporary history is that in the same period in history in which apartheid in South Africa was brought to an end and was considered discredited and considered unacceptable, we have allowed, and when I say we in this case, I mean the United States. The United States has allowed and furthered and helped finance the bringing of apartheid to the Middle East in the guise of a false peace process.
We're going to have to stop right there for just a moment. We're speaking with Mark Bruzansky, who is the director of the Middle East Realities at MiddleEast.org. We're going to take a break. Joe C. Hughes and Straight Talk. We'll be right back.
1570 KMCD color radar weather brought to you by Taco John's of Fairfield on this Taco Tuesday. Tonight, mostly cloudy and windy. We could have some flurries, low 26. Tomorrow, cloudy, a chance of sleet or snow showers, high 40. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy, low 20. Then Thursday, partly sunny, high 45. Well, Taco Tuesday means two crispy tacos, just $1.29. Order potato, lays, and a drink. It's a complete meal and a great deal for dinner on Taco Tuesday at Taco John's in Fairfield. That's the forecast here at 1570 KMCD.
Josie Houston, Straight Talk Radio. We're back. We're speaking with Mark Bruzansky from Washington, D.C., and he is the director of Middle East Realities. Mark, it's clear to me that our listeners and myself, we need to have some websites, some books. We need to know about this because it's clear that I'll speak for myself. I do not understand the Middle Eastern situation, and it is complex, it is detailed, and it looks as if we're not on the right track, and may not get on the right track, and the consequences are severe. Give us your coordinates at your website, and then I think you've got a book or two that you've written as well.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. I will, of course, tell you about our own website, because our own website gives links to so many things, so many of the foreign publications, so many of the writers we think are most important, so many of the things that aren't generally available to Americans, and that's why we've created the website. That's why we call it Mideast Realities. It's not, frankly, fun and easy to do these things because you're constantly swimming upstream in this country. People calling you all kinds of names, anti-American, anti-Jewish, self-hating Jews. We're doing it because it's terribly important that people understand how our world got to this point, the role the United States really plays in that world, why so many people do hate us, even though our culture is so much emulated and so much desired in many places. And, well, as you said before, we're at MiddleEast.org on the Internet. That's MiddleEast, no spaces, .org. We're also at MERTV.org, where we try to show a weekly TV program, but unfortunately we're not sufficiently funded. You know, I'm sure you've heard the story. Small independent organizations have a very hard time finding sponsorship and support because the message that they're putting out there is not the kind of thing that the institutions in this society necessarily want people to know about. Information itself is power, and the big corporations and the government try very hard to control the information flow to the society, and MiddleEast.org has many links available to it. Noam Chomsky's books, Chomsky, are absolutely excellent. You can find them in just about any good bookstore. Frankly, my own books, published some years back at Congressional Quarterly in the Woodrow Wilson Center, they're for specialists and academics. I don't recommend them for a general audience. I do recommend MiddleEast.org because there's a great wealth of information there and a great wealth of links. And there's no way to understand the situation without delving into it and without realizing that after years and years of brainwashing, it takes quite a while to be able to see through the smokescreens and to be able to see through the ruses and to see through the duplicity and see more clearly just how things appear once you leave the shores of the United States and once you are not constantly bombarded by American government propaganda. And I know those are harsh words. I know most people would like to think their government isn't so duplicitous and isn't so chicanerous. But let's look at what this administration especially is doing. Who did they hire for the to be the Assistant Secretary of State for Information? Did they hire a diplomat? Did they hire a historian? Did they hire a scholar? No. They went to Madison Avenue and they hired a former advertising executive whose job it is to sell U.S. foreign policy just like she used to sell Uncle Ben's rice.
Now, let me ask you a question. We're speaking with Mark Brusansky in Washington, D.C., the director of Middle East Realities, and this is a fascinating topic. You mentioned Noam Chomsky and I think R.N.D. Roy, and I noticed that you'd published in The Nation. Now, those are, and we shy away from these terms on our radio program because they have a limited meaning. But those are publications and or writers that would be considered quote-unquote liberal, right or wrong. What would, say, the opposite end of that political spectrum be, the National Review, for example? How would they, listening to what you said, how would they respond to it?
I'm not going to try to speak for them. I don't read them. I don't respect them on these issues. You can find some great writing in some of those publications, and some of the right wing even comes to the defense of civil liberties these days. But when it comes to foreign policy and when it comes to Middle East affairs, I know of nobody on the right who makes sense to me. Most of them, I give you an example. He's not far on the right, but he does represent Fox News. I've been on Fox News a couple of times. I'm sitting in the chair with makeup, talking to a guy they've asked to come on with me. He's their regular guy, And frankly, at the name, at the moment, his name escapes me. It was a couple of years ago. But he's their liberal black commentator, but of course for the conservative Fox News. So by my standards, he's not liberal at all. He's very mainstream to conservative. But as we're sitting there, we're discussing, okay, I'm the Middle East expert, and they've asked me to come on their program to talk about what's going on. And then they called him quickly to come on over to sort of balance my views. And I said, okay, you know, that's fine. I agreed. What's your background in the Middle East? He says, oh, you mean background in the Middle East? Well, I said, you know, where have you been and when's the last time you were over there? Oh, he says, oh, I've never been over there. I'm just the commentator for Fox News. And you've got a lot of that crap going on in this country. A lot of people on TV and with names in magazines who don't have the foggiest idea what they're talking about. But since they're talking to a population that also doesn't know too much about it,
so
they get away with it.
Because when I'm listening, I mean, first of all, as I'm listening to you, it's clear to me that you know a lot about the topic. You've spent a lot of time there. Now, I'll give you an example of an epiphany for me. I was listening to, I don't know, C-SPAN or something, and they had a British journalist come on, and he said words to this effect. He said he has spent a lot of time in Israel, and he made a comment. He said that, and I don't know if he was speaking of, I think he was speaking of the Israeli government, and he was saying one thing that people don't understand is that they're, and he used the term arrogant, they're quite arrogant, and he cited an example of a Palestinian settlement that had been in a particular region for, I think, generations or even hundreds of years, and an Israeli development, meaning housing development, had come in, and this Palestinian group of families had been using a particular well for generations. This well was, in effect, commandeered by this housing development without compensation. And basically these homes were built essentially on their land.
But that's common.
And what I'm saying is that to me was, gee, well, that doesn't seem reasonable. That doesn't seem fair. And what you're saying is that's commonplace.
That happens all the time. The United States has made it possible. The United States has supplied the funds. Many American Jews are the ones living in the settlements. Billions of dollars have been provided to Israel. It's the listeners here whose tax dollars and whose country have made all of that possible. That's the reason you have suicide bombers these days.
And from that perspective, certainly, while you don't condone suicide bombings of any type, certainly you would understand a motivation for that.
Well, yes, but as I said, information is power, and the government works, and the corporations work, and the big media work in this country to keep the information from you. I mean, let's take Chomsky. Here's an intellectual of world stature. Whatever one thinks of his political philosophy, be he left or right or whatever he is, even the New York Times, of course, I know you think of that as some great liberal publication on Middle East issues. That's hardly the way I think of it. But even the New York Times has called Chomsky someone that can be likened to Plato and Aristotle. He's booked years in advance. He goes all over the world and commands huge intellectual audiences. But is he ever given a chance to appear on any major American talk shows and then really given an opportunity to speak up? Once or twice a year, maybe for a couple of minutes when he's put on a panel, or maybe once on C-SPAN now and then. Yes, it does happen. But it doesn't happen like anywhere near the weekly commentators we're subjected to. And as you thoughtfully mentioned to me, you would describe yourself in a certain way. Most of your listeners come from the political right wing in the United States. I grew up in the Midwest, so I'm not unfamiliar with the United States. Had my life taken a different turn, and had I not made 150 trips abroad and met so many people, maybe I'm sure my views would be very different. But what we share is a tremendous, I think what we share is a belief in truthfulness and honesty and constitutional government and lawful government and not being propagandized and misled and lied to. And unfortunately, I'm afraid that's what our government has come to represent, not only abroad with the CIA, But here domestically, with the control of the media, with the setting up of false think tanks, I mean, look at Washington. There's a thing called the U.S. Institute for Peace. You'd think the U.S. Institute for Peace would be some serious independent organization. It's not. It's funded by the U.S. Congress, and it's usually a former ambassador who heads it, or the Woodrow Wilson Center at the Smithsonian Institute for Scholars. You'd think it would be an independent institution. No, funded by the Congress, so it has to yearly get its money there and be approved. And it's not even, they no longer even have an academic who heads it. They used to have Jim Billington from Princeton, who at least was a recognized academic. After Jim, they sent him over to the Library of Congress, and they asked the chairman, the retiring chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee of the Congress, to go head this independent, or this supposedly independent academic institution. So there's a tremendous amount of propaganda, misrepresentation. We're a very sophisticated society. We do things in very complex ways. Unless you live here and see it and understand the rules of the road, it's pretty hard to fathom it. But at the end of the day, the price we're paying is pretty severe, because not only did 9/11 happen, and I emphasize again, in my considered view, it would not have happened but for the policies we've pursued, the wrong policies we've pursued. It was essentially mass suicide bombing. Had that, not only did that happen, but now we're spending huge amounts of money to build up our military-industrial complex. The infrastructure of our society, the basic institutions of our society are all being shortchanged. My God, I was at a national park this weekend, and it's become a trash-free park because they're afraid to even have trash containers in the national park because somebody might put something in them. I mean, that's, you know, when
that's where we've lost our liberties, right there.
When Time magazine made the decision who was going to be man of the year, they made the wrong decision. They made the safe and the easy and the politically correct decision. So they chose, you know, Rudy Giuliani. Quite clearly, since the definition of man of the year was supposed to be whoever has had the greatest impact, be it for good or be it for bad, clearly Osama bin Laden gets that nod. We don't even have trash cans in our national parks anymore.
Mark, we're going to take a break and we'll be right back. We're speaking with Mark Bruzonski, is the director of the Middle East Realities. Josie, who's in Straight Talk, we'll be right back.
What's going on in your world? Well, that's what we talk about every weekday evening from 6 to 9 here on the Bruce Williams Show. Won't you join me here on the Talk of Southeast Iowa, 1570 KMCD.
Josie Houston, Straight Talk Radio. Welcome back. We're speaking with Mark Bruzonski in Washington, D.C. He's the director of Middle East Realities. We're talking about the complex issue of the Middle East, and I want to shift the attention here in a moment to some solutions. But it seems to me that this is not, I don't view this as a conservative or a liberal issue. In fact, I don't particularly view many issues as a conservative or a liberal issue. I'm looking for solutions which are constitutional, which are typically free market driven, and really are also truth-based. And obviously, if the American public is being intentionally or unintentionally misled about an area which clearly is a tinderbox and ready to explode, then, and clearly with 9/11, our liberties were abridged. We have to go through complex metal detectors and armed guards at airports. We can't, as you just mentioned before the break, we can't have a trash can in the national park. Clearly, we the American population, whether we're liberal or conservative, is not the point. The point is we've had our liberties abridged, and whether we are liberals or conservatives or don't even view the world in that way, we all want our freedoms. And so we need to understand what's going on over there, and now to the point of how do we solve it? And let's take a quick...
It's the right question, but it's the wrong forum. Can't do it in a couple of minutes. Until one understands the predicament we're in, until one understands not just the flaws in our foreign policy, but the dangers in our domestic situation and how we've gotten to this point, it's not even possible to begin the extensive discussion of what to do about it. We're in far worse shape now than any time in my lifetime, and the whole liberal right debate in this country is totally out of whack as far as I'm concerned. There are some common values we all hold, but those values have been so twisted and credibility is so little at this point that people just don't know who to turn to. And I fear the turn in our civil liberties is now such that it's not going to be easy to right that balance. And, you know, all one has to do is just look at the kinds of things that are happening. You've got an attorney general who's so right-wing. I use that term in my definition, so obviously your listeners will have to, you know, take into account the circles that I'm part of, the international circles that I'm part of. But he can't even figure out what to do with a 1930 statue in the Justice Department that's been there all these years without causing any stir. But because there's what looks like a naked breast on this statue, as I say, it's been there since 1930, and he feels he has to go out and get a drape for it. You know, the poor man. Apparently he's never, you know, left the shores of this country either. Then you've got all kinds of, for the first time since World War II, we have what look to me like illegal detentions in this country. Now, I'm not saying the federal government shouldn't be able to arrest people. I'm not saying that the FBI shouldn't be able to go to a judge and present its evidence and maybe even have that evidence under seal, and then the judge issues a warrant and somebody gets arrested. And then, as we always do in this country, because it's police states that don't do this, we let attorneys visit those defendants if they're charged with something, and there's a public accounting of who was arrested and for what reason and for what period of time. But that's no longer the case in this country. For the first time, we have maybe thousands of people who are in jail. Most of them, in the great majority of them, have no charges pending against them. In many cases, we don't even know where they are. We don't even know what their names are. Most of these are what we call aliens, meaning people that are not U.S. citizens but have been living here for a long period of time. But I emphasize again, no charges have been brought against them. No due process has been followed. There are no courts involved. There are no attorneys involved. This should be, to the right wing in this country, of greatest concern, and yet I don't see that happening.
What do we do now that we're in the predicament? We are in the predicament. 9/11 has happened, and all of the events that we've all that you've outlined that the U.S. government has contributed to are underway, and we're beating the war drums relative to Iraq as we speak, for example. What do we do with Iraq and its interest in building weapons of mass destruction, which would be directed towards us?
Well, first of all, you know, the country that has real weapons of mass destruction that brought them to the Middle East, the country that has a huge arsenal,
and
an army that's 8 times stronger than all the Arab armies, including Iraq combined, is our ally, Israel.
Right.
Saddam Hussein, if he has anything, has a few puny weapons. And of course, Iran and China and India and Pakistan, of course these countries are developing weapons of mass destruction. Who was it that taught them that weapons of mass destruction bring power? It was the United States, of course. And who is it that is now going around the world threatening to use these weapons? The big country that has all the technological weapons, all the super weapons, all the conventional weapons, is nevertheless publicly now saying, we may make a first strike if we determine it's in our interest using weapons of mass destruction. So who in the world is it that's actually creating this proliferation?
Well, I know. I think I know where you're going.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was obvious at that point. And there is no easy fix, believe me. If there were
Yeah, I think we're beyond easy fixes at this point.
We're in a potentially catastrophic situation.
But one thing's for sure is that we need the truth, and sooner is better, and we clearly haven't been getting it, and we clearly, there are interests that are decidedly opposed to the American public getting the full story.
If you want one idea, I don't know how to bring it about, and I'm not capable of bringing it about, but we need a national network. Radio, TV, media. We need something that reaches millions of people and that's national, in which the motivation for bringing people on is not to get corporate sponsorship, not to please the military industrial complex, not to get government grants, but one place where the best scholars, the best academics, the most truthful people, whether they're left, right, center, that doesn't matter to me. Pat Buchanan's an interesting personality. Some of the things Pat has said about the Middle East overlap with some of the things I say, but not for the same motivations. Pat's coming from a very different place and finding his reasons for things in a very different way than I do. But nevertheless, I do consider him a fairly straightforward and honest personality, unlike some other names we could bring up. Mr. Keyes would be a good one on the other side of that. But you on the right, for instance, I think should be listening to people like Chomsky. Noam is a genius with facts and figures, and he's been largely pushed out of your circles by being discredited as a liberal and as a radical precisely because they don't want you to hear him. He might influence you.
Well, I tell you, person, that I do subscribe to the Nation. I've subscribed to the National Review since I've been a babe. But I subscribe to the Nation, and certainly Christopher Hitchens is a standout.
Well, he was. I know Christopher personally.
But I think he's
He's lost his balance. Vanity Fair has gotten to him. He started enjoying those parties too much, and I knew Christopher when he was far less sullied. Oh, he's a brilliant writer. No question.
Brilliant
writer, brilliant speaker, a lot of fun, but Christopher's an entertainer, and he takes pride in being an entertainer, and Vanity Fair has bought him to be an entertainer, and I'm afraid Vanity Fair has rubbed off on poor Christopher.
We're actually going to go ahead and wrap up, and I very much enjoyed this talk and this.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity, and it's MiddleEast.org on the Internet, and let's see if we can somehow all pull together and have this national network and invite people because of their expertise and honesty and truthfulness rather than their political affiliation.
Interesting thought, and I think the first thing that we need is the truth about what's going on in the Middle East and who all the vested interests are, and I think that'll certainly help us to.
And if I may also, the phone number to Mideast Realities is 202-362-5266.
We've been speaking with Mark Brzozinski, who is the director of Middle East Realities. It's been a great show. Nice to have you on, Mark.